This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Severe coastal flooding during storms in January and March of this year jolted Massachusetts residents and officials into an unwelcome awareness of just how vulnerable we are to rising sea levels. Last week, we brought you some of the latest science on how high the water will get and what that might mean for coastal roads in the next few decades. This week, we turn our attention to the issue of how much it will cost to prepare for those inevitable impacts. Last month, Governor Baker announced a $1.4 billion bond bill to finance climate resilience efforts in the Commonwealth. Now, a UMass Boston analysis finds that, not surprisingly maybe, that's not enough. They say that near to midterm adaptation measures for Boston alone will likely cost between $1 and $2.5 billion. Joining me now is David Levy. He's a professor of management and director of the Center for Sustainable Enterprise and Regional Competitiveness at UMass Boston. David, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Thank you, and thanks for having me on the show.
I'm going to guess that an analysis like this takes more than a month or two, that maybe these storms this winter weren't what prompted it. What did get you started on looking at this question of how to finance and how much money we'll need to adapt to rising sea levels?
This has been part of a longer-term process initiated by the city of Boston, particularly after Superstorm Sandy caused over $50 billion worth of damage in the New York, New Jersey area. So Boston woke up when we realized that had Hurricane Sandy, what was Hurricane, became a superstorm, by the time it reached Boston, it was low tide here, but had it hit Boston at high tide, it would have also caused very substantial damage. And cities up and down the East Coast have been waking up to this issue and beginning a process of planning. So the Climate Ready Boston process has modeled the impact of sea level rise of storms. There have been several studies of the potential damage, and now there are some neighborhood studies in South Boston, in East Boston, Charlestown, and looking at the extent of damage and what kind of plans can be put into place and how, moving towards implementation, how can we fund these projects that are going to be needed to prevent future damage.
Well, as you mentioned, there is this longer process, and in fact, it goes back before Superstorm Sandy. You know, since the Global Warming Solutions Act was passed in 2010, we've had state mandates saying we need to assess our vulnerability, we need to create adaptation plans, all of these things. But is this the first time now with the bond bill that Governor Baker announced that Massachusetts is actually putting money on the table to start addressing these impacts?
Well, as you say, the concern with climate change certainly predates this. I think most of the effort beforehand has been with greenhouse gas mitigation, reducing the consumption of fossil fuels. More recently, we've begun to turn our attention to the what we call climate adaptation problem, our recognition that we're not going to be able to stop this, that we've already baked in sufficient sea level rise and worsening storms, so we are going to have to deal with it. But yeah, there has been money prior to this. There is some money in various federal programs, FEMA programs, EPA, NOAA. But at the state level, I think this is the largest single chunk of money that's going to be there for to begin to address some of these needs. But as you say, $1.5 billion sounds like a lot, but it's not going to be enough over the longer term. It's a down payment.
Right. And the punchline of your study is this $1 to $2.4 billion figure. That's just what you say would be needed for near to midterm kind of district level, just greater Boston level adaptation.
That's right.
What kinds of things might that money cover?
So that number is something of an estimate because the report is out and available online. If anybody wants to Google Climate Ready Boston or Climate Ready East Boston, the report is out there and it identifies a number of projects that are needed in East Boston to protect the Greenway from flooding, Piers Park. And, you know, I mean, you can look at the map and see the various areas where water would come in and run down the Greenway and flood. So it's really establishing a perimeter around the neighborhood, and that would be raised several feet above the the 100-year storm level. So that's going to take significant coordination. In some places, it's raising roads, it's spaces between buildings, it's constructing berms and some green areas. So in each neighborhood, it requires establishing that perimeter, coordinating with the property owners, some retrofits. In some areas, there might be some new property developed. East Boston is relatively cheap in a sense that there are, at least in the short term, only a couple of places where the water is going to come in. In the Seaport, South Boston area, the problem is much bigger, and that's because it's much more exposed, it's all low-lying, and there's just a much bigger frontage that needs attention. And that's why it's an order of magnitude larger. If we're talking about 40 or 50 million in the East Boston area, it could well be 10 times that. The numbers aren't out yet and the report isn't final. But, we are looking at several hundred million at least in the South Boston area. And the numbers for downtown as well, that study hasn't really been started yet. So you can begin to see that the money begins to add up. At the same time, it should be said that you've got to compare this against the cost of inaction in Boston. And the Climate Ready Boston report that's already out is estimating that as we get towards the 2070s, the annualized cost, in other words, the average expected cost per year, is going to be about $1.5 billion. So we need to invest this money to protect the city, but we will see a return from it in terms of preventive damage.
And that's just Boston, the city, as you said.
That's right.
Are you or is anyone looking at the whole state and what the cost might be to protect our hundreds of miles of coastline and coastal communities or to help them better adapt to this new reality?
I would say not yet in an integrated way. A number of cities and towns are beginning to look. I know Cambridge has got a study which looks at this, but it tends to be the larger cities and towns which have some resources that are able to conduct these studies, because it requires a significant investment with various kinds of consultants and doing the modeling. And we do need more of a metro region approach, because so many other people commute into Boston and benefit from the city. So residents of Newton, Brookline, Cambridge, all the surrounding areas need to be part of this process, contributing. There's a pretty good case that the metro region and even everybody in the state should be putting something towards this. I mean, one of our key conclusions is that we need a layered financing approach because of that, both to make it financially feasible, but also to recognize that the whole state benefits from having a vibrant economic hub in Boston.
I'm talking with David Levy of UMass Boston about his analyses of the costs of adapting to rising sea level. As you said, kind of some of the top level conclusions of the report, there's no free lunch. We're going to have to pay for this. And there's no silver bullet. There's no one way to do this. So what are some of the places and mechanisms we might turn to come up with the large sums of money, the billions of dollars that we're talking about, to get our coasts ready for the inevitable impacts of sea level rise?
So I think we're looking at an incremental approach. I mean, it's important to remember we don't have to spend this all in one day. It can be staggered over a period of years. And as the science gets better and we know whether we're looking at 1 to 3 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century, or whether it is, in fact, worst case, 6 to 10 feet, then we can scale and build over time. And what we're looking at is on the financial side, I think it's going to be important to establish a state level resilience fund. It's great that this $1.5 billion is being established, this initial fund in Baker's bill. But what we're proposing as well is to tie some funding to the ultimate cause of climate change, which is carbon, burning carbon-based fuels and greenhouse gas emissions. And that means either some kind of carbon tax. There are currently two bills in front of the House which would impose a carbon tax or a carbon fee might sound more politically feasible. And one of those does channel 20% of the resulting funds into various forms of clean energy and climate adaptation resilience measures. The general idea is that most of the money would be recycled into lower income tax rates. We've also got a very low gasoline tax in the state. I mean, just adding 5 cents to the gasoline tax in Massachusetts would generate about $150 million a year. And these are the kinds of amounts that would work quite well. If it would be enough to back a very significant bond that could get some of these projects jump-started. We've already got the REGI cap and trade process here, which puts a cap on carbon, and the permits are auctioned. If that cap was tightened, it could also generate some funds. I'm not suggesting we do all of these, but a carbon-based mechanism at the state level is probably a good way to raise some of these funds.
So all of those are politically touchy taxes or fees imposed on people. And then you also mentioned that we need more accurate pricing of risk.
Mm-hmm.
A carbon tax or a gas tax could maybe be part of that. But I wonder if you're also hinting at higher insurance rates as a mechanism of financing here.
That's right. That's right. I mean, and it's true, all of these are politically sensitive. But at some level, we have to confront the issue that we are going to have to pay for resilience. It's not free. There isn't really a free lunch here. There are some co-benefits. We can build better and we can get more resilient transportation and power supplies. And so there will be benefits to the region as well as amenities, public parks, but we have to pay for it. And so one way or another, if we don't do this, the region isn't going to be competitive and companies aren't going to be locating here. And we also have to recognize that there are vulnerable communities who are going to be differentially impacted, low-income communities which tend not to have the insurance or resources that enable communities to recover and might have lower quality housing to begin with. So we do have to bite this bullet. Risk pricing, yes, insurance is an important piece of this, and insurance is the price of risk. And by getting the price right, we can influence incentives. In other words, if imagine some large commercial buildings down near the waterfront, if as insurance rates rise, these companies or the building owners will decide, okay, we need to upgrade the resilience of our building, and maybe then we can push the insurance cost back down again. Or they might consider relocating. So the property price might begin to fall in some of these areas.
You've noted in two different regards the fact that low-income groups and communities of color are more vulnerable to these climate impacts. They don't necessarily have the resources to even do the kinds of assessments, the risk models that you were talking about, and then don't necessarily have the resources to respond to a disaster. What kinds of programs or policies would you like to see put in place to make sure that these vulnerable populations in Massachusetts are being supported, as well as the better resourced communities in our state?
Yes, that's very important. It's important that low-income communities and communities of color are included in the decision-making and planning processes, so that as plans are drawn up for East Boston, for other areas of the city, that the local communities have a say. And we hear some of the priorities here from the community groups aren't necessarily the same. The priorities might be ensuring access to employment, ensuring access to healthcare. That means transportation. It might mean being able to shelter in place. It might mean making sure that there's compensation if people lose days of work. People who are being paid by the hour in service jobs are suffering much more when a neighborhood or a city is shut down for a few days because of these kinds of events. So it's inclusion, and it's also structuring the finance so that it's not just about market rates, but there are programs that will make it easier, basically, you know, subsidizing insurance or various subsidized loan programs for lower income households to be able to upgrade the facilities, their residences, their homes. And if it's low income housing, a lot of people are renting, so it has to be channeled through the building owners in those areas to provide an incentive for them to upgrade the homes. So anyway, this is going to have to be a multi-layered. I don't claim to have all the answers right now, but clearly we have to take into account equity and make sure that we're not just protecting the wealthier neighborhoods.
That's David Levy. He is a professor of management and director of the Center for Sustainable Enterprise and Regional Competitiveness at UMass Boston and author of a new analysis of climate resilience finance. David, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.